Discord and how to apply that. Oh, actually, Chris, maybe you do want to use the screen. Anyways, if you do, yeah. So how to apply that to the neutron interferometry problem that we talked about. But first, since it just came up, let's introduce the quantum discord. So if I have a stick and parameterize it, like so. And then Reuters defined the quantum, the concurrence, C, as equal to now I should check my notes because make sure that I actually got the order of this thing right. The concurrence is useful in understanding what happens with a pure state and the entanglement. And it's easy to show that the concurrence, I know I have this here somewhere, is zero for a separable state. And so what the concurrence is measuring is the separability of the state. It's not, and particularly the separability of a pure state. The discord is measuring something different. The discord is telling us if we have a state, is it consistent with classical ideas of probability? Okay, well, while Chris is talking, I'll find this somewhere. Oh, here it is. Hold on. That's not so bad. Forgot the factor two. So, easy to show that this lies between 0 and 1, that if the state is separable, it is 0. If it is fully entangled, so one of the Bell states, it's 1. Okay. So remember the problem that we laid out. The problem said we have a neutron interferometer. That we're going to create in this neutron interferometer an entangled state. And we're going to create an entangled state of the spin and path information. We're going to entangle spin and path. In order to do that, we'll have a state that comes in with a pure spin state, so the incoming wave function. Is that? We'll put the spin flipper here. And we'll, to create the maximally entangled state, then that spin flipper should be 180-degree rotation of the spin. So we'll end up with the spin down and up. And so now here we have our entangled state. Zero down, plus 1. So, yeah. Now we wanted to add some complexity to the problem. So the first complexity we added was to take the blades and say that there's a transmission coefficient. And so we have T not equal to R at these two blades. This blade still looks like a perfect mirror. And we forget about the neutrons that leave the interferometer just as normal. And we add into these noise. So we add in the phase noise as well. Okay, now we ask, as we change this angle, as we change the transmission reflection coefficient, as we add noise, where do we see the system deviating from classical dynamics? Can we point to areas that say, if we want to see a uniquely quantum signature in this state, how perfect does our interferometer have to be? And what states should we look at to see that deviation? Okay, so since Chris has worked it all out. To introduce the discord and say explicitly how you calculate the discord, and then to show the result and to show the next step of what you're going to do when you add phase. Okay.
Did anyone read that paper? I looked at it. Does anyone know what the transformation is?
Okay, that's a start. Do I have to use that thing?
You do. I want you to keep this for
frustrating.
Does it work? I have to send you home and you put a tie on so you can clip it on.
All right. I haven't looked at this stuff for a while. Okay, so I'll just start with classical information theory to review some things. So first of all, we have the Shannon entropy for a classical system A, which is defined as minus the sum over A of the probability of that system taking a state A. Times the logarithm. And then you can define the conditional entropy to be the sum over B like that, and then you can expand that out again. Okay, and then using these two things, you can define an expression.
Oh, yeah. Where did the log come from?
The log. It's expanding out that in terms of this definition.
You mean?
Where what?
Sorry, in your definition of H, A, Y, and B.
Yeah.
But you don't see any logs, and I don't see anywhere that could be substituted to get a log.
This log.
Should there be a log in front of that second line?
Sorry. This should be a H. Okay. All right, and then you can define an expression for the mutual information between system A and B. To be like that. And then you can also, in classical information theory, you can use Bayes' theorem, which states the conditional entropy is
the entropy of the joint system minus the entropy of the second system. And using this relationship, you can rewrite an equivalent expression for mutual information, which is given by the entropy of A minus the entropy of B minus the joint entropy. So then,
can you give us an intuitive understanding of what mutual information is?
I think it's essentially how much overlap there is between the probability distributions of the two variables. Like, if there's no overlap, then this conditional probability can be factorized into separate probabilities. If there is some overlap, then one can. Determining an outcome of one will influence the probability distribution of the other thing you measure.
So if there's no mutual, if there's no overlap, then the mutual information would be zero.
Yeah. Okay. So the next thing we want to do is generalize these to quantum systems. So for starters, for our systems A, the equivalent of the probability distribution is the density matrix. So we'll have the density matrix for a joint system AB, and we define the reduced density matrices for system A and system B to be the partial trace of the joint distribution. And then we can define the Shannon entropy for a density matrix to be minus rho log rho, which when you actually calculate it is more convenient to write it as minus the sum of the eigenvalues of rho log with the eigenvalues, where we define for an eigenvalue of 0, we define 0 log 0 to be 0. And the log taking base 2. Yep?
I believe that should be plus HP on your minus 1 there, where you defined by A colon B.
Maybe. Unless I got that one wrong. Yeah. Okay. So using this definition, it's easy to generalize this one to a quantum expression for mutual information. We simply swap the Shannon entropies for the von Neumann entropy. So the quantum mutual information find the entropy of the two reduced density matrices and minus the entropy of the joint system. The tricky bit comes with generalizing the conditional entropy for a quantum system, because unlike classical systems, in quantum systems, when you perform a measurement on one system, it collapses or influences the state of the whole system. So that's what we want to do now. Okay, so we'll use the notion of von Neumann measurements, which consist of a one-dimensional set of orthogonal projectors. So I'll choose them to be acting on system B, though you could equivalently define it with the projectors acting on system A. So we have that, trace the orthogonal and their projectors. Okay, and then if we perform a measurement on the joint system, the state of the joint system after measurement by projector I will denote like this. And that states, given by this expression, where PI is the probability of the ith outcome of the measurement occurring. It's given by that. Okay. So using this, we can define an expression for the entropy, the entropy of the joint state, the conditional entropy of a joint state, conditional on a set of measurements given by pi b. The notation kind of gets progressively more awful. Yep.
We just have it as zero.
So do we avoid that case, or we just like?
I think it's just to I'm not sure. Renormalize it. I'm tempted to say that. Yeah, if the state row AB is completely orthogonal to this projector, then you just have to put that in as a zero matrix, and it works. Otherwise, it all breaks. yeah, that's a good point, because then the other one will be one for the probability. So you define the conditional entropy. The sum over the probability of the outcome times the entropy of that state, sum over all the measurement outcomes. And then using this, now we can write a quantum version of the other description for mutual information, which is given by the entropy of the G system A minus this entropy conditional on the set of measurements on system B, like that. Okay, so the whole reason we do this is in classical information, I and J are equal, but in quantum, they need not be equal. So that allows us to define an expression which we call the quantum discord, which I'll denote. As I said, we define these measurements on system B, you could equivalently do it for system A. So I denote that by this. In the other case, I would have done BA. And we minimize this over the projectors on B. And that's our expression for the quantum discord of a bipartite state, rho AB.
Would the quantum discord go to zero in the limit of H bar greater than zero? You know?
No idea.
Kind of a curve of constant.
We don't have H bars appearing anywhere, only when we do this stuff.
So you have to define a system that you're interested in. So you say, you know, some oscillator, and then yes, it must. But you'd have to put it in the system description, not in this.
Okay. So, all right. So two properties of the discord is, one, the discord's strictly non-negative. So, and it actually has a lower bound of zero, for what we call a classical state, which I'll define in a second, and an upper bound of 1 for a maximally entangled state, such as one of the Bell states. And over here. So if a state rho AB has zero discord, this only happens if performing the complete set of measurements doesn't change the state. And that's discord's usually taken as a sense of determining the classicality or quantumness of a state. So there's some subtleties in that, which I don't fully understand. But one interesting thing about the discord is you can define a separable state that's not entangled, which will still have a non-zero discord. So for example, you could conceive of a density matrix which, I don't know. Looks like this. And then no set of orthogonal projectors on the system B will leave this state in the same state because these are orthogonal. And there's no entanglement in that state, but there's still some degree of quantum that's happening because measuring system B will influence the state of system A. Okay, so that's discord in a nutshell. I don't know how I'm going to show these pictures. I don't have a thing to connect my computer with.
I didn't bring my computer.
Well, there's not many people.
Yeah, I'll just crowd around the lobby.
So essentially what I did was take what we did in class yesterday and define, well, a couple years ago, I did some work on this, so I had some really, really, really inefficient code lying around for calculating the discord. And okay. Essentially, what mine does is you define a set of orthogonal projectors and then work out this value over all possible parameters for all possible projectors in a giant array and then find the minimum. So
for that system?
For any state you give it. For just a 2-qubit state. So this is a 2-qubit state, so you can do it for that. And so I didn't put in the noise yet. This is only as a function of the transmission coefficient of the first and third blades being the same and how much of a phase rotation the spin flipper does.
So everything you have here is a pure state?
Yeah, so they're all pure states. So if you can see that picture there, the height's the discord, so where it's red off the top, that corresponds to a discord of 1, which means the output was maximally entangled. And that only occurs for when we have an ideal system with a perfect spin flipper and the perfect interference on the first and third blades. And then it decays off, not quite as a sine squared. Yeah, it's zero, but if you've got pure transmission or reflection on the incoming blades or no spin flip.
So the x and y axes are t and r?
One of these is phase and one's transmission coefficient.
Right, t. Okay.
And the height's the common discord.
And so the you define t and r, you know, the spine and the subject one. So
right, right. So it's the same. Yeah. And the phase, we don't have a phase flipper here, right? So
the phase is acting on the
in subsystem.
Okay, I see.
So that's the bit that's called contact.
Right, yeah.
Without that, it's all classical.
So in one direction, we're measuring, in some sense, the entanglement. Well, the discord,
it isn't a good definition of entanglement,
right,
but it can tell you something maximally entangled.
No, yeah, what I'm not saying that, but I mean, discord is a way of measuring how the thing deviates from classical.
So discord is a way of asking, is the probability of some measurement consistent with the classical description of probability?
Right.
Okay. And entanglement is asking, well, could you distill a Bell state? It's asking, is there, is the state itself something beyond a separable state? So there are two different things. The discord, well, you've thought about this more than I have, but the discord I associate with focusing on the measurements.
Yeah, I think of it more as a causation type of thing. It kind of gives you a measure of, if you think of, say, system A and B, one being your system and one being an environment you can't access, you can think of how much information you could gain about the environment from measuring A or something like that. Or how much it can, like, how much, yeah, measurements you perform on one system can have an effect on a correlated system.
The other question I have is that, I mean, maybe in experimental, these things are, this is probably not an important thing to do, but your plot looks simple enough for it to be, it probably has some sort of analytic expression. So have you thought about that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Essentially, you have to push out the analytical expressions for the entropies and then minimize those the same projectors.
Right.
Which, for simple things, you can do, but it gets quite difficult very fast. Especially if you've got several parameters playing around.
Right. Now, I was just wondering if it is something worth doing.
Probably.
So.
Well, I wonder, actually, in the case that we're going to look at next, where we have a Gaussian distribution, then again, you get an analytic result. But as soon as you move beyond that,
I
doubt that you can get anything analytic, even in such a small window space.
I don't know how useful an expression
is. No, I'm just asking.
Unless you want to know what the set of projectors are that minimize the discord for, say, some experimental setup. Yeah.
So it'd be interesting to know if, for such a simple system, how the currents in the discord, you know, here we still have.
Well, I'm not sure
system.
In this system, but if concurrence is zero for any separable state, in general, the discord should become non-zero first, because it can be non-zero for separable states.
That's right.
But I'm not sure in this state. I think it will be similar, because as we have it now, we haven't allowed mixed states, so as soon as it's non-zero, it's an entangled state, and it's good.
Yeah, that's so if we look at this thing again on your... So certainly we expect that once we add noise,
at one point
we'll see that difference. But even here, you know, we know that at zero and one, they're going to coincide. But beyond that, the discord still is, can rise faster. And, but not, you know, if you took the line where the transmission coefficient is 0.5, and you're varying the angle, then I think they should be the same.
But if you don't have the perfect...
Right, but if it lost that line, I'm not sure that they should be the same.
Okay.
What's below that?
With the concurrence, if you're using density matrices instead of... You only know the value of the coefficient squared. Does it matter that you're using, like, a complex base? Yeah?
The discord is a mess once you have...
once you go through a pure state.
So you have to do it again, but instead of using density matrices, just use a state vector to define it. Yeah.
But I mean, since this is a pure state, everything's well defined.
You can do that.
That's not a problem.
Yeah. I don't. Well, yeah, you select the calculator, you just call the density matrices, but independently using the state vector.
Mm-hmm.
The expression for the discord that you wrote down looks like it's the determinant of some true edge matrix. Is there some significance to that?
Thank you. I was going to ask Bill, who was here a couple of weeks ago. I don't think so. I think it just relates the theta and sine tangle states and the fact that you can't rotate between them. Maybe there's more to it.
That paper you sent, it sounds like there's lots of different possible measures for entanglement and quantumness and things.
Right.
And some of them coincide at certain points, but they're different. But it's like the something inequality, quantity inequality or something.
Yeah.
And these other things.
Well, it's surprising that even with just two qubits, it's such a rich area to discuss.
Has anyone tried to do something like this before? Four qubits? Do they still just split it into two even bar finite states, or can you have different dimensions?
It's easiest to describe entanglement or the quantumness if you think about bipartite separations, and most of those things, there's a nice measure by David Meyer called the Q measure of entanglement, which has the advantage of being monotonic. As we think about entangled states, it is just a sum over the loss of entropy as we take all the possible bipartite splittings of a multipartite state. So we just average over all of
that.
There are
So that would work for a three qubit system?
It does.
It doesn't matter if they're different dimensions of splittings?
No, you can still define the entropies. And so you can still look at the loss of entropy of those things. And of course, in those systems, you've seen that there's two possibilities. So-called GAT states that have a symmetry like this, and the Werner states, which normalize look like that. And there, if you look at the GAT state, the top states, these are both maximally entangled states. If you lose a particle in the top state, then of course you've lost all your coherence in the system. Reduce the system, you reduce density matrices back to the identity. But in the lower one, you can lose a particle without losing, or you can measure a particle if you like, without losing entanglement. So there's entanglement that's left as you make a measurement of one of any one of the particles in the lower state. And you find in literature two different ideas of entanglement measurements. One, that's sort of what I like, is to say the top state is more entangled. Because if you make a measurement, you completely lose all the bottom. So you say, it's incredibly fragile. And so it's more entangled. But then there's the other school of thought that says the lower state's more entangled. Because even it's entangled when you make a measurement. And so there's more measures of this entanglement than I know what to do with. And
would it help to introduce another idea, which is orthogonal to entanglement, to disentangle this?
Yeah, so it's, you know, then it becomes a trick of saying, what's the process that you need?
Is there, like, why do you actually need?
Why do you need to have some measure of entanglement?
Right.
We think of entanglement as a quantum resource, so that if we're going to ask what the power of a processor is that can use entanglement, we would like to be able to quantify that compared to a classical processor. And if we want to quantify something, we need to have a quantifiable measure of entanglement.
Okay, so like, the different, like,
this is how,
like, the different measures of entanglement you gave us can be used differently. Like, is there, presumably, if you know what you want to use it for, you'd be able to figure out which one it is that we need. It is that
So I'm not the best person to answer that authoritatively, but yes, if we're thinking about a communication protocol, then we do know what the measures of the states that they're going to use over that communication, over that quantum channel are. And so there's an awful lot of work in communication protocols on channel capacities and how they relate to various measurements of entanglement over the shared resources that the parties have. In quantum computing, or in quantum simulation, or in quantum measurement, I don't think those things are as well developed as they are for communication protocols. In general, there's four or five modeling that describes lots of entanglement measures. Look at those. And arbitrary polynomials. Series of papers on these channel capacities. Have a look at those. This is paper that I sent you. Wasn't so much that here's yet another measure. I mean, as far as I could tell, the measure actually seems very, very close to this score.
I think that said it was equivalent, like the discord is more general or something.
Okay.
Yeah. This is equivalent in one at some point.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I use the other ones as often little pounds.
So if it's equivalent to Discord, what was the point?
I don't know, they mentioned like Discord is a throwaway sentence at some point in the introduction, saying it's equivalent at some point.
Okay.
I didn't say how.
So
I didn't work through any of the calculations though. Yeah.
Well, my point still with them is to say that, or actually with this one, is the quantumness of a neutron interferometry is an interesting question. Scientifically, it is something which is debated, but like many things, it's debated without actually concretely getting down to the calculation of, well, here's the answer. And having developed the answer, particularly if you develop the answer with this phase noise, then that is a result that people would be interested in. And so, you know, you should consider publishing that along with the description of, this is what the system looks like, and here's how you get to that point. There's the last remaining question of, is it fair? I don't know the answer to this.
Do you want to start?
No. Yeah, you have to answer the question. Is it fair to disregard the neutrons that we lose in the system? And if we were going to include those, how would we include those? Because they never show up as a measurement. Would we have to put the, you know, you could imagine saying, oh, we'll put another helium detector out there so that we'll have a measure of what we missed. But certainly, in terms of the H and O beam detectors, there is an indication of how much we miss. Because remember that, that the contrast curves are shifted up from zero. And you know, however much they're shifted up from zero is related to them being shifted down from the maximum. But I'm not sure that that's a really useful way. Any ideas?
Would it affect the purity in the final state at all?
Well, it depends on what you define the final state. If you say that the final state is just the neutrons that you measure in your O and H detector, then no, right? Because you measure them where you don't measure them. In a sense, yeah, you can't count something that you don't measure. It doesn't. Yeah.
Did you use your four-path interferometer to bring back those beams and see if that changes substantially the discord? And then say, well, now we're losing a similar amount of neutrons at each of these points, but those paths are now damped out by the transmission and reflection coefficients, and basically you could build up a series approximation of as you add more.
So what Chris is suggesting is take this neutron interferometer, and now have this overabundance of paths. And imagine that here he puts a detector and two phase shifters. There. So if I was looking here, then you can see that this phase shifter doesn't control the probability of neutrons arriving here. That only this phase shifter does. And so by adjusting this phase shifter, we can control the probability of keeping neutrons inside. Now, of course, we're still losing here, okay? But, you know, this event and this event are supposed to be the same. So this is we control the probability that neutrons remain in the interferometer. And this phase plot, notice that this beam and this beam are parallel, this beam and this beam are parallel. Right? So this phase plot doesn't control the neutrons that arrive here. It controls the interference of neutrons at the final wave. So this is controls the interference that we observe. Okay, so now if I think about writing these conditional probabilities, and then we say that we have these two independent parameters. One that looks just like what you've done already. And this is the second one that controls some aspect of the scaling of the device. And to ask, should that scaling be added as an impurity? It's very funny to think of adding, normally if I think about adding a loss of purity, and think of adding an identity component to the system. And if we're making a measurement, the identity component should be that we have neutrons hitting the detectors. Right? But now we're adding an identity, we're adding a mixed part of the density matrix, but it's mixed in just such a way that it never reaches the detectors. And I don't actually know what would be a nice formal way of including that physics?
You were saying that we don't, that the loss at the third blade there, where at the top and bottom is somehow the same as...
Well, the physics is the same. So what we have coming out here is no difference in physics than what's going out here. I mean, here we don't have any control over that.
Right.
No, it's just half the
time. But I mean, the same...
Because there's no interference of things.
Right. The same question, though, why doesn't the same question arise, though, about what, how that makes it up the same?
Well, I think it does, but if you could get your hand around this question, where we have control, where we have a knob that says if there's leakage or there's no leakage. You know, imagine, for instance, that you go back and ask, well, we have this fair sampling criteria. It says that as we lose neutrons, there's something unique with the neutrons we lose, that they're just like any other neutron. And here we have a test of that fair sampling criteria, because as we rotate this blade, regardless of how we rotate this blade, we should see the same contrast curve here, the only difference being the intensity of that contrast curve. And if we didn't see the same contrast curve, then I think we'd be forced to say that the fair sampling criteria was somehow violated. And so to put that into our description of the measure, clearly if we did see that that was a change, then we couldn't treat that as though we were simply adding an identity. We really have to treat it as though there was some additional underlying physics.
Has that been done experimentally?
No, we're the first people that have this interferometer. And so we're still running the basic experiments. And unfortunately, with the interferometers, it takes a month or so to run an even simple experiment. It can take a month to get this thing aligned. So everything is very slow. Now, what we have right now is the reactor is going to run for another year. It's going to shut down for a year. So we're thinking very carefully about how we want to spend that year with measurements. And part of my focusing on neutron interferometry is very current about thinking, what should we be doing?
It's us in Washington?
No, we need a reactor, so it's in Gaithersburg, Maryland, in the United States. There's unfortunately no reactors with cold neutron sources in Canada. Canada, started the field with broadcast, but they didn't maintain their lead in this. They gave up a lot of nice condensed matter physics, the work that was done at McMaster.
But you use like power reactors, or?
No, we use a research reactor, so it's about 20 megawatt reactors. I think that's much too small. Sounds like a lot, but it's much too small for a power reactor.
So the reactor is like solely for the purpose of making neutrons?
Yeah.
How much did it cost?
Fortunately, the government paid for everything. It's very expensive. We're just changing the guide fault floor, so we're adding another cold source and changing the thrones. And just to reconfigure things and for the dole down, it's $100 million. And the reactor we don't touch. that's big stuff.
Is there a feeling that it's a good case result? I mean, obviously they can still find it.
Yeah, absolutely. That using neutrons are unique for us. That if we think about looking at chemistry, we can use neutrons to probe hydrogen. Whereas we can't use X-rays to probe hydrogen, we can't use light because they don't scatter them, they're too light. But it's exactly because they're so light that they scatter neutrons very effectively.
What is probe hydrogen?
What's that?
What does probe hydrogen
mean? Oh, it means to be able to tell where hydrogen is in the crystal.
Oh, okay.
So I want to know, for instance, if we have a protein and the protein crystallizes, then the water that's in that crystal determines what the crystal structure is. And using X-ray techniques, we can certainly tell the crystal structure of the protein because we can look at the background atoms. But we can't tell where the water is, and we have to resort to electrodynamic simulations to try to stick in some water. With neutron techniques, you can probe the water directly. In fact, you can also tell the motion of the water in these proteins. And protein folding is a big current problem as we try to understand drugs and biochemistry and the rest of the water.
I'm kind of familiar with that concern. I guess I don't want to take a super effect, but like, why is there water in the crystal and or in the protein?
Because it's hydrogen bonded to the protein.
Okay.
Whatever biomolecule you're looking at, it uses water to create proton pumps. Many of these proteins are bound in membranes, so you can't think about them as being free of solution, but they actually have some complex geometric configuration.
So I should make you think of like a large covalently bonded molecule with water's hydrogen bonded onto it.
Mm-hmm.
And when you grind it up to crystallize it, the waters don't get ripped up, just stick on.
The hydrogen bonding is really quite strong, and so when you crystallize it, the crystal structure, the conformation it adopts depends upon those interactions. Yeah, I'm kind of into the biology, very quickly get outside. But the other for looking at biochemistry, biomolecules, it's very important. For looking at magnetics, it's very important. If they have a probe that we can look inside metals or inside hard magnets, looking at the magnetic domains. So the Valkas primes was just given to Michael Dragas in physics here. We're looking at frustration in spin glasses, essentially. So looking at solid-state devices. And there, the advantage of having neutrons is that neutrons penetrate. So if they don't have charge, you can send them through metal. They'll come out the other side, and their spin will report on what the spin is in the metal, just as we saw when we put that non-commutative spin rotator in the neutron interferometer. There we wanted just a hard magnetic domain. What they would be looking at is some more complicated magnetic domain. And then there's some strange applications. If you have aluminum or other metals, you get some first inclusions of hydrogen, and they make the metal brittle. Test that, and so you want to have a probe that you can send through the metal, so you come up the other side. It's not going to interact with the metal itself; it's going to interact with the hydrogen. The metals are perfect for that. There's a nice web page in this describing the facility in the neutron physics. And we'd better stop, I guess. So I meant to spend a few minutes on spinner dynamics and show you that we can use neutron interferometry to see spinner dynamics. In fact, this is the first spinner behavior that was seen. Remember that when we have a spin 1/2 particle, we rotate it by 2 pi, it's a change in sign. And you say, okay, how do we see that? You can't see it with an individual particle. But if I do it in an interferometry experiment, and I rotate the spin on one arm of the interferometer, then we can see that. And so that we'll have a look at next class.
Are you willing to share your credits with people?
Good.
And with me?
Okay.
Even better.
So we'll look forward to get that from you. And are you going to add the phase noise?
I'll try.
Good.
Thank you. Yeah, I was reading Sakurai last night about the spin neutron interferometry thing.
Oh.
So there's a little section in Sakurai.
It's in Fernandes.
Yeah.
Good. Good, we'll do that. We'll look at that tomorrow. And think about this piece. It's an interesting question, and I don't know what the answer is of should one care about that particular, those neutrons that are leaving. It seems like in this experiment, since we have control over that probability, that we should somehow care about it. I don't know.
Could we do a similar experiment with optics and polarization to, it won't obviously convince us, but to somehow lend ethics to fair sampling assumptions?
It's harder to do an experiment with optics to test fair sampling than other people have done. With neutrons, we have the advantage that that the neutrons are not absorbed, they're just sent somewhere.
So what do you kind of scatter up every time?
What's that?
What are they scattering on? I imagine enough to be electron.
No, the nucleus. Right. So you have a neutron, and so if I have two nuclei and they're going to interact with each other, the strongest interactions with their masses are the same. And so that's why neutrons interact so strongly with hydrogen.
Is it mostly?
It's just a thing about it as an elastic scattering of it.
How do I model with it?
Exactly, it's an elastic scattering. So you take two millibrols that are going to interact, right? If I take a bowling ball and a ping pong ball, and throw the ping pong ball at the bowling ball, the ping pong ball will go across the room, and the bowling ball's not going to move. Whereas if I, take out there two pool balls and I hit them, then they're both going to move.
So you use a tangential
weight. The ping pong ball bouncing off the bowling ball tells you, I know where it was. It tells you very little about the mass, right? All it tells you is that it ran into a wall somewhere.
Right.
Whereas the billiard ball bouncing off the other billiard ball tells you both where it was and what the mass was.
Right. So I put the neutron, say, at the center of my foot system, and use a thought that.
Why?
In particular, how do I use the radius? There's not, a neutron isn't actually a top hat, right? It's not this hard to hold.
It's okay, because, nuclear potentials are hard.
But what
I think is there's no Coulomb interaction.
Right, but what's actually scattering? I have a bag of quarks and a bag of quarks.
Okay, why do you use the restroom?
Okay,
1 second, then I'm tough.
Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, but then again, I've seen the paper too, so. But no.